Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens. In this podcast, I ask my guests to reveal the seemingly insignificant things from their life that personally they treasure so much that they would like to see them preserved in a time capsule. They pick four things they love, but one thing that is important, but which they wish they could erase from their life. We then talk about each thing before sealing it in a time capsule and burying it in the ground. My guest this week is the actor Kevin Bishop, who started his career as a boy in Grange Hill before being cast as Jim Hawkins in the film Muppet Treasure Island. He went on to appear in numerous TV shows, including his own series, The Kevin Bishop Show. He was in Pie in the Sky, Love Soup, My Family, Peep Show, New Tricks, Benidorm, Murder in Successville, Nigel Farage Gets His Life Back, in which he played the titular character, Detectorists, The Tracy Ullman Show, Plebs, and a whole series of Porridge, where he played Nigel Norman Fletcher. He played the title role in the TV film Dick Whittington and has been in over 20 other films, such as Horrible Histories, the movie, Rotten Romans, A Few Less Men and A Few Best Men, where he gives the funniest best man speech in any film, in my opinion, David Brent, Life on the Road, Moonwalkers, and Keith Lemon, the film. This episode with Kevin was recorded some time ago at his home during that envious time in the distant past when two people could be in the same room without masks and without fear of killing each other. I look forward to making more recordings this way again, soon. Roll on the vaccine. Actually, don't roll on it. Put it in my arm. Thanks. But in the meantime, I hope this reminds you of joys past and happinesses to come. I slightly suspect that actually you're a liar. I think that you're one of three triplets and that you spend all your time sharing out the things that you do in your life, because I've never known anybody who's as busy as you.
My wife would disagree with that. She sounds very lazy. But, I'm always trying to keep busy doing other stuff. Hobbies. You have to have hobbies,
don't you?
Especially when you're an actor, you know, and make acting your hobby. I think that's the secret, isn't it?
And you don't feel any pressure when you sort of say, "Well, I'm not actually doing the acting, but that's just a hobby."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, an actor did say to me when I was really young. He said, "Kevin, when you can make acting your hobby, you've cracked it." And I remember thinking, "Whatever." And now I'm nearly 40. I think. Oh, God, I wish it was my hobby and not my living.
My advice to young people who are thinking of going into acting is, well, become an amateur.
Yeah.
Aim high.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, there is something about that. I mean, my daughter took part in a local thing that they wanted to get school kids for the Sound of Music, and she was one of the Von Trapp kids. And I saw her in her performance. And I saw all the other actors on stage and I thought, They are enjoying this so much.
Yeah.
And they're doing it because they love it. And I thought, God, there's not many actors that have that moment of serenity on stage. You know, there's something about it being your work as well, and your, you know, how you get your money and stuff, that does remove a bit of the art and the beauty of doing it.
Yeah, in fact, the joy of theatre often only occurs to you when you're in the wings, I think.
I agree. I've had that moment a few times. I'll do a lot of work with gorillas, and I remember we were going on sort of tour with them, or I'll see them in concert, and just being at the backstage and seeing the sea of thousands and thousands of people. And then you see the performer in front of you, and then the sea of people in front of them. And it's incredible. Yeah. And you just think, wow, it's the closest that you'll ever get to actually being a rock star yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I remember we did this thing at the O2 with the Muppets. The Muppets did they said, hey, Kevin, we want you to come and perform with the Muppets at the O2. You're like family to us, and we'd love to get you back. And I'm thinking, Jesus, I'm going to the O2, right, okay. So we go to the O2, and it was mental. It was completely mental. I mean, just thousands and thousands and thousands of people there.
It's huge.
Ridiculous, yeah. I mean, there's something scarier about performing to a theatre that only holds 600 people than going somewhere like the O2. The size of the O2, obviously, but there's something kind of, I don't know, it removes you from the fear of it, because it's just like walking out into space, you know, like there's no, you don't really, it's just weird, yeah. I'm scared of smaller crowds than I am of big crowds.
Oh, no, my experience has always been the other way around. Whenever I've done those great big concerts, I think, how can they possibly see me? And, you know, I end up jumping about a lot and pulling enormous faces in a desperate attempt to come across the footlights, as it were.
Yeah, hamming it up, love.
Yeah,
hamming
that's it up. Me.
Well, that was always my problem with theatre, as I always think, as an actor going to see theatre, I struggle sometimes in going to see plays, and I which is a nightmare because I have to go to the theatre all the time to see friends in plays. But but I always find people act differently when they're on stage to when they do when they're sort of in life, and suddenly they start standing differently and shouting and the whole posture of their body changes completely, and I always find it looks really contrived. So I struggle. And every now and again, you go and see a brilliant play where they still manage to project really well and whatever, but you can't see them doing their acting, as it were. You know, but they're few and far between, aren't they?
They are. They really are.
Those shows.
Particularly the beginning of a play, because it seems so alien what people are doing. And it's because, really, they're making their voice heard right to the back of the theatre or something. If you're at open-air theatre, and it starts in the light, and strangely enough, your voice doesn't carry as well in the light.
Yeah,
once it gets dark, there's less ambient noise. And so you can talk much more quietly in the dark than you can in the light.
Oh, that's very true, because it's whenever you see Shakespeare in the park or something like that, you know, and they're performing, you always think, I can't hear a word they're saying.
No.
And it's because there's so much ambient noise around, and there's a 61 bus and of course, and all those little sounds,
and
you're
birds
pitching and over, yeah.
And then suddenly it goes dark, and they're sitting on their own on the stage, almost whispering.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Yeah,
but it is strange that beginning where people walk on stage and really bellow.
Yeah,
yes, I'll have a cup of tea.
Yeah, I hate that.
What?
I hate that so much. For me, I hear that and I immediately, I've got some trauma definitely from my childhood in a theatre where it went on too long or something. Because as soon as they come out and they do that, I just think, get me out of here. I've got to get out. And what my body does is my rebellion against it is to fall asleep. It's like narcolepsy. And it's really terrible because I don't fall asleep ever unless I'm in bed. But for some reason, if there's something I don't want to be, like theatre or I don't know, a maths class, or if I'm in church, somewhere where I really mustn't go to sleep, but somewhere where I'm required to pay attention, then I will go to sleep. I never fall asleep in the cinema. I can sit through the dullest films, no problem, never walk out. But theatre, if I get stuck in a bad play, that's it. I can't keep my head up. I'm out for the count. I hate it when actors go, what are you up to, love? Are you busy, darling? And I go, yeah, I'm just doing this thing. And they go, I say, what are you doing? And they say, we're doing a play at the Globe. You must come. I say, brilliant. How long is it? And that's my first question. They go, it's 4 hours each half. There's an interval, but then you go, I'm like, listen, don't promote that.
Yeah, you can stand all the way through it.
I don't want to go to that. I'm not going to that. Like, stop promoting it. If it was me, I'd be ashamed to say I'm in a 4 hour play. I'd say, don't come, it's 4 hours, it's fucking horrendous. Just stay away, save yourself. Please don't come. Don't pretend you're going to come, because you're not going to come. It's fine. It's 4 hours. Nobody should write 4 hours play. I think there should be a law. There should be a law, a 90-minute theatre, and that's it. I'm all for that.
Yeah. Right, so we've got this time capsule, and what I'm going to ask you to do is to find five things from your life that you'd like to put in it.
Right, okay. So I'd been going out with my wife just for a couple of weeks. We've been together 19 years. And then I went away and made a film in Barcelona.
Mm.
And I said to her, you're going to have to leave your job and come and live with me in my hotel in Barcelona, because I miss you. I'm lovesick. And so she did. She quit her job and she came and lived with me in my hotel. But the director was this brilliant director, really lovely man called Ventura Pons. He was a Catalan director. And Ventura Pons, he was this man. He said to me, Kevin. They can't say Kevin. They say Kevin. They can't pronounce the V. So he said to me, Kevin, I want you to come to Caracas. It's a place my family for many years have this place. You can come. You can stay with me for a few days. We have a house very close to Salvador Dali. He used to live in this place. And he was a very good friend of mine for 30 years. A very, very good friend of my family.
And everybody was a friend of his for 30 years.
And whenever he said he knew someone, he always go, he was a very, very good friend of mine for 30 years. So we go to Caracas in this car with Ventura and his partner. And we drive along this country road and we get to Caracas. And there's this incredible... I mean, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a beautiful place.
No, I haven't.
It really is lovely. And Salvador Dali lived there. And I remember there was this mist was rolling off of the cliffs. Like a really sort of prehistoric feel to it. It was mental. And then we went out in this boat to this beautiful little island. And we had fideuá, which is like paella, but the noodles.
Mm.
And we had the fideuá there with the ayo sauce. And it was the first time I'd ever had it. I was 20 years old. It was the first time I'd ever eaten that food. And I was with my wife, Castor, and we were both really young and in love. And I was making this film. The film was called The Food of Love with Geraldine McEwan and Juliette Stevenson, Paul Rees and Anna Corduna. And it was just an incredible weekend. And I remember we stayed in this hotel, and in the hotel, it was so hot, there was no air conditioning. So we took the mattress off the bed and slept on the balcony.
Wow.
Outside on the hotel. And we had wine and cheese and stuff out on the balcony and then slept on the balcony. And I always remember it to this day as just like, boy, one of the happiest moments ever of my young life. You know, I'd left home. It was the first time I'd really been away from home. And like working long term and, you know, like just this freedom and Barcelona and Spain. And I just fell in love with the place. I completely fell in love with it. Yeah, and that was really just the start of an incredible sort of experience.
So when you fell in love with your wife at this time, because if I think back to my falling in love with my wife, I was rather strange, I think, or she thought I was strange, because I would always talk about us way in the future. I would talk about us when we were old. So when we're old, and she would say, well, we might not be together. But I had no doubt about it.
Yeah.
I was completely confident in the fact that this would happen, these things would come about.
It's interesting, that stuff, isn't it? Because I always wonder, like, as soon as I met Castor, I was just like, well, that's it. Like, that's just it. I'm always going to be with you. Maybe that's because of my childhood. My parents are still together and they were sort of childhood sweethearts. And I just always, I thought, well, that's just the way it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's just acceptance.
I've been to Spain several times and done some interesting things, and it's always those sort of off-the-wall moments that are the most memorable, aren't they?
Well, those are those moments, I think, in your life. There's moments that I look back on that I remember being in the moment and thinking, I'm never going to forget this.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you really don't. You know, like, I remember the first time I did a play, and it was Chichester, and I'd left home to go to do this play, and the cast were incredible. It was Steve Spears, Tom Georgeson, Deborah Gillette, Andrew Lansell, Alec Newman, Russell Tovey, who I shared a flat with.
Wow.
And we were kids. We were like 18, 19.
Yeah.
It was Nicholas Leprevaux. Nick was playing the piano, singing songs, poetry over there. And I walked over and he said, "What are you fucking doing over here, you cockney? You've scared all the girls off." And I absolutely loved Nick. I mean, he was just such fun. And I found some photographs recently of me with Russ and Nick and Steve and everyone else. And we're so young. Mm. They're so young. Nick is so young. And I thought he was really old because I was only 19. And I think, Jesus, he's only a couple of years older than me.
No.
You know, because it's 20-something years ago.
Yeah.
And that was just an amazing time. But I had this flat. Russell and I, we rented this flat from this woman who was very posh. And you know, I wanted all the money up front. You know, I want the money up front. And I remember we basically, there was more money than to get the flat than we were earning. And every night we'd go to the Bell Pub, which is opposite Chichester Festival Theatre. And we'd have quite a few drinks. And we'd be sort of staggering home, and then you'd get a call. "Hello, darling, it's Nick. Look, I seem to be a little bit inebriated. I'm really not really able to drive a Volvo home back to Tunbridge. So, would you and Russell mind if I slept on the floor in the thing?" And this was every night. And we had, it was like a sort of menagerie of these reprobate actors.
Brilliant.
Steve Spears going, "Okay, boy, I'm coming over. I'm going to stay at yours. Hope you don't mind. I've had a few. Don't worry. I got this lump. I got a lump." He's been doing that for 20 years, and I've been worried about him for 20 years, and he's still going strong. He's still smoking, his Marlboro Lights. And it was brilliant. I mean, just a fantastic time where what I really noticed about the actors was that there was no, we were all the same age. You know, I mean, mentally, we were completely the same age. It was irrelevant.
It's a fabulous thing, isn't it? That's the thing that it's very difficult to explain to other people who aren't actors.
Yeah.
That the hierarchy of acting is absolutely based on the part.
Yeah. I mean, an actor said to me once, I said, "What is it you love about doing what we do?" And he said, "Well, it delays the onset of adulthood." He said, "Because when you're an actor, you just don't ever really have to grow up, do you, really? It's like a sort of, you know, you just carry on doing what you're doing and getting by and enjoying things and dressing up, essentially, and mucking about, which is really what it is." And I totally agree. And I love the company of actors. I find that actors are just, we realise there's a finite amount of time to the job that we're on.
Mm.
And so it's like, we're on this thing for 6 weeks and then it's bloody done.
Yeah.
You know?
We'll never see each other.
There we are, darling. Then we're back to unemployment, love.
Yeah.
You know, and there is, and we'll never, and we'll never, we won't work with each other possibly ever again, or at least for 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
So.
And then you jump straight back in again.
Yeah.
If you've not been apart.
Yeah. And that is the best thing. And I always find that, well, I remember in the early days as a child actor and you'd be going for a read through. And this is, I'm talking about, you know, the mid-90s or whatever. And people would go, "Should we go to the pub? Go to the pub, pub lunch. And all these actors of all ages all going to the pub.
Yeah.
And we used to go, we'd have a drink and we'd have a lunch. And that's how we did it.
Mm.
And that's how we bonded. Because we realised it was like a little bit like going to war. Like, we had to bond really quickly.
Yes.
Because we're going to be on stage in a couple of weeks. And we need to get all this stuff done. You know, we need to break all these things that you work with someone in an office and you wouldn't get to know, you know, John from accounts for 10 years. And then suddenly you'd see him at the office party and strike up a conversation. This is instant with actors.
Yes.
You know, because it has to be. There's no time for...
No.
For getting to know each other slowly. It's like, who are you? What are you about?
Actors things almost immediately, don't you? Your most extraordinary secrets.
Yeah.
You tell them at the first coffee break.
Yeah. It's essential that they know that about you. That's what I think. You know, I think it's essential that we just cut to the chase, you know, and I love that about actors. You know, I really love that about actors. And I think that comedians are much more guarded. Comedians get themselves into a headspace where they think, I'm so funny. Who's going to make me laugh?
Yeah.
And then someone does make them laugh, and they don't like it.
If you sit in a room with a bunch of comedians, there are lots of people saying very funny things, and everybody else scoring them.
And I'm I'd be guilty of that myself. I think when you get involved with comedy and you start creating comedy, then you do start to dissect everything. I mean, I was watching an episode of Arrested Development the other night, and I was studying the camera angles, and I just thought, what am I doing?
Mm.
Like, and I was going, oh, that's all handheld, that. And I thought, what's happened to me? I can't even watch bloody... I love comedy. Like, what am I doing? You know, like, every performance, I'm thinking they've cross-shot that. That's how they did that. They've cross-shot that. And that's how they and that sort of... I remember when I was a kid and I was in Grange Hill, and I loved Grange Hill. I watched every episode. I was a big fan of Grange Hill. And I turned up to Boreham Wood, where we used to film it, and they said, do you want to see the playground? And I was like, yeah. And they walked me out into the playground, and I thought, going out into the Grange Hill playground?
Yeah.
And then they showed me this car park where there were cars parked in the playground, and... that's the wall where we shoot the so-and-so scene. And it's just a plastic wall and a set. And I remember the bittersweet sort of day of, like, I'm on Grange Hill. And also the realisation that it's all, just none of it's real. Yeah. One of the things actually I mentioned, I was going to mention today, was that, you know, was working with the Muppets as a child.
Mm.
And I always had this thing where I thought, because I worked with Tim Curry... and people say, what was it like to work with Tim Curry? And Tim Curry bought me a CD Walkman at the end of the job. I mean, in the mid-60s, this is how old it is. So he bought me a CD Walkman at the time. That was, you know,
fantastic.
That was a great present. I mean, it was, you know, CD Walkman was, it was, wow, you know, CDs on the go. You know, this is incredible. And he said, I very specifically remember him walking me down this. We're in Shepperton Studios, and he's walking me across the lot and giving me this present on the lot. That's a penultimate day. He went, you know, I just want to say sorry for you know, by being a bit standoffish. I have been quite standoffish throughout filming, because I just feel like it, you know, wouldn't really help the character that he was friends with Jim Hawkins, and he had really been standoffish, but at the time I thought, oh, he hates me. but I, now I'm an adult and I work on set. Now, I was a really overbearing child. Like, I had lots of, believe it or not, Mike, I was very, very, I had lots of energy. And, you know, people would say, are you hyperactive? And my mum used to sort of get very upset. But I was completely hyperactive. And I was bouncing off the walls. And also, I was very irreverent and didn't really pay much respect to anybody, because I just thought that it was just a great laugh that we were filming. And I look back on those times and I think, yeah, I sometimes when I work on set and the kids turn up and they're little shits. And I think, oh, God, he's coming over again, that little kid. Oh, God, he's a horrible child. And you know, it's funny how you sort of, you know, you change. So I forgive Tim. I do forgive Tim for being incredibly standoffish, but I was a very overbearing child. And we were up in the crow's nest in Muppet Treasure Island, up on the ship. They've got this false pirate ship in a huge studio on this huge jig thing.
Mm.
And it mimicked the motion of a boat at sea. And they very, very early CGI at the back. And then they put shots of the Caribbean behind it. We didn't go to the Caribbean once. We shot the whole thing in Shepperton. Anyway, Tim and I had a whole day in a crow's nest at the top of this ship with Basquiat. And it was just really awkward. And there were just hours of silence in this crow's nest. I'm 14. And I'm really cheeky. And Tim Curry is this brilliant, you know, well-respected, you know, actor up in this crow's nest. You know. And I just, in a moment of awkwardness, I said, I mean, be honest, Tim, I said, Rocky Horror Picture Show, those fishnets. I said, you're never going to live those down, are you? And he just took a drag on his cigarette and he looked at me and went, not as long as wankers like you keep bringing it up. It was so inappropriate to say it to a 14-year-old, but we both had a real laugh. And then he said, you really are a sublime wanker, Gavin. And then it became our little private joke, yeah. Sublime. And if someone came over, he'd say, he's quite sublime, isn't he? Meaning, he's a wanker. So, I mean, that was an incredible experience. I mean, it was one of the best experiences of my whole life. I mean, working with the Muppets, age 14.
Yeah.
Just amazing. And they were just lovely people. They were like a family. And when you work with the Muppets, you never really lose contact with them, which is quite incredible, because of all the jobs that I've done over the years, and you just move on, you can't even remember if you work with them again or when you work with them or not, you know. With the Muppets, there's always something. And I've had lunch with them in Los Angeles, dinners with them in Los Angeles and New York, and where we've all just hooked up. And
that's brilliant.
Yeah, even still. And it is incredible. And when they asked me to do the O2, I was just so flattered that they... And they made a Muppet of me. I have a Muppet of me. They made one of me, one of Tim Curry, and one of Michael Caine.
Wow.
Because Michael Caine was in Muppet Christmas Carol.
Christmas Carol, which many people say is the best version of A Christmas Carol.
It's fantastic. Mm. I saw it in the cinema. It was the first one before Treasure Island was the second one. Jim Henson had died a few years before, and Brian had made Muppet Christmas Carol. Mm. And I went to see it in the cinema, and I remember thinking, this is the best Christmas film I've ever seen. And a couple of years later, I was on set Muppet Treasure Island.
My word.
Yeah.
You must have felt blessed.
It was insane. I mean, it was, and also I'd been fired from Grange Hill for being just the naughtiest child in the world. Yeah. They just said, you got to go. You can't, this is a working environment. This is not, you know, a juvenile detention centre. You just got to go. And they fired me. And I remember telling my dad, he said, I've got a call. You've been fired from Grange Hill. And he said, only my son could be expelled from a fictional school. Well, all the kids were going, oh, man, you're in so much trouble now, man, because, like, you've been kicked out of Grange Hill, man. That's it now. That is it now. Oh, my days. Oh, man, you must be so embarrassed, man. You must be gutted, man. You must be gutted. You're kicked out of Grange Hill. And I was like, at the time, my parents were mortified. I was really worried about it. But do you know what? Like, within a few months, I was the lead in a Muppet film, and I wouldn't have been if I hadn't have been expelled from Grange Hill. So it worked in my favour.
Well, that's it's lovely. Now, I'm going to take the three things that you've mentioned to me so far. I'm going to take these. These are going to go into the time capsule.
All right, okay.
I think you should definitely put you and your wife, or I suppose then girlfriend, lying on a balcony, drinking wine, eating cheese. I have to say, I'm really jealous. And also, I think that you at Chichester with those actors, and then actually feeling for the first time, in a way, like an adult, and thinking, here I am, I'm away from home, and I'm with these people, and we're all together, and it's fantastically unitarian. There's no hierarchy here. We're all just having a brilliant time together and being honest and open with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was one of those moments where I thought, this is what it feels like to be a proper working theatre actor.
Mm.
And I love it, and I want to do it again. That was me done.
Yeah,
I knew at that moment at 19. I just thought, there's nothing else I can do but this, and somehow I have to stay employed in this this field.
You're very happy to work in the theatre, not to go to it.
Yeah, I'll be in a four-hour play. I'll be in one, but I'm not watching one. Because, it's, you know, that's the other thing people don't see when they watch a play. They just think we're all just standing there in the wings. We're not. We're downstairs, mucking about in the dressing room, you know, playing pranks on each other whilst you're, you know, deep in Brecht. Because we're terrible, aren't we? I mean, we do a play after about 3 or 4 weeks. We're all getting bored, aren't we? We're like, oh, God, we've got to do this for another 3 months. You know, it's terrible, isn't it?
It's terrible.
I mean, really,
it's like, dream of the job.
Yeah.
And the moment you get it, you start saying, oh, this goes on forever.
Oh, God, yeah. But it's the great actor's joke, isn't it? The actor who hasn't worked for years and his wife's getting very worried about him. She says, any auditions? He said, no, nothing. Nothing. Well, it's at this rate, I might have to give up. And then one day he gets this audition. She says, I've got an audition. She goes, brilliant, brilliant. You've got an audition. He goes in, goes up for the audition. She comes up, how did it go? He goes, I don't know. Finds out he's got the part. She says, well done. Well done. That's brilliant. He says, I know. She says, when do you film? He goes, I go away Monday. She says, oh, fantastic. Cornwall, brilliant. Gets back in his hotel room after the first day, phones his wife, and she says, how did it go? He says, oh, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Director was lovely. Loved what I did. Loved everything I did. Thought it was brilliant. She says, oh, I'm so pleased for you. You haven't worked for all that time. That's brilliant. He says, yeah, but you know what the best thing is, though? She goes, what? He goes, I've got tomorrow off. That's just...
It's so true.
In a bloody nutshell, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. So we've got your wife on the balcony.
Yes.
I've got you at Chichester.
Yes.
And also I've got you up in the crow's nest.
Yes.
On the Muppet movie.
On the Muppet movie with Tim Curry. Bless him.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here for some adverts. That's how we pay for this podcast. We'll be back in a moment.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back. Right, let's find out what the fourth thing is that Kevin Bishop would like to put into his time capsule.
Another moment that I remember very fondly in my mind was the birth of my first daughter. And I think I have some kind of photographic memory because when I remember events, I remember what people were wearing. I remember I had a mustard T-shirt on that said pie and mash on it. And when my wife's waters... No, it was when her waters hadn't broken, actually. But she said, they've started... The contractions have started. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I looked at her and I said, right, okay, what do we do then? She went, I don't know. And she said, I can feel them. The contractions are happening. And if I'd have known the baby wasn't going to be born for another 40 hours or whatever from that point, I would have told her to lie down, get some more kip, because it just went on forever. Yeah. But we lived in Brighton, in the North Lane area. And then I remember we got up, phoned the hospital. They said, just relax, come in a bit later on. But I remember going to the hospital in Brighton, and it's in a high rise. It's really up high. And you can see the pier and everything. out the window. And we got in there and my wife had pre-packed her special baby bag because everything was, you know, locked and loaded and ready to go. And I remember she had a musical playlist. She had on her iPod. It was an iPod. And we go into the hospital and the contractions, and then she's saying, rub my back. So I have a rub her back. And then like another day went past. I'm like, oh, I'm exhausted. I'm absolutely exhausted. And I was falling asleep. And she was saying, wake up! I'm in pain! And I was like, yeah, I said, well, you know, I haven't got agonising pain. Keep me awake, come on. I'm very insensitive of you. And then she said, get my playlist. And I just picked up the phone and just pressed play. And Come On Eileen came on. It wasn't her baby playlist. This was just random music. I just put Come On Eileen. I thought it was a really hilarious choice. And my wife was furious. And I remember the gas and air that my wife was on the hospital. And I was just taking this gas and air. And I was just on this gas and air. And by the end of it, I was saying to the nurse, this gas and air is fantastic. Where can you get this stuff? She said, well, it's not actually available. I was saying, listen, if I wanted to get some of this, I'd pay you. I mean, this is unbelievable. She said, could you please give the gas and air back to your wife now, Kevin? And I remember looking out of the window of Brighton Hospital over the pier, completely off my face on gas and air. And then my beautiful baby was born, Arabella. And she came out and it was insane. Like, her eyes were wide open. She wasn't crying and she was looking around the room like some kind of sort of tiny gremlin or something like that, but just the biggest eyes. And they were blue and they were open. And it was very, really mad experience. And I remember being really shocked that it was a girl, because everybody had told us, oh yes, the heartbeat sounds like a train, and yes, it's going to be a boy, definitely a boy. So we just assumed it was going to be a boy because that's what everyone had told us. And I saw it was this girl, and I remember being really chuffed that it was a girl. And I remember it had been like 48 hours. Neither of us had been to sleep. My wife looked so exhausted by the end of it, and I remember just looking at my wife and feeling so proud of her. I just thinking, how has she done this? Like, it was so hard. The birth was so hard. And I remember she looked at me at one point and she said, I don't think I can do this. And I remember thinking, she's got a point. I don't think she can. We're going to have to pop it back in and we have to go away and let it cook for a bit longer and come back with a bit in a couple of days. We can't do this now, but that's not how it works. It's coming. Like, and you've got to do it. You've got to keep going. And I just, such respect for her for getting through that. I couldn't do this.
You really feel for the generation where it would have been ridiculous for a man to have been in the labour ward with his wife. But that experience of watching your wife go through that extraordinary pain.
Yeah.
And that incredible physical demand upon her body.
Yeah.
Is something you never forget, isn't it?
I totally agree. I mean, You get closer to them, don't you? Because I remember thinking at the time, I remember thinking, God, this is so unfair that she has to do this. And, you know, that's what I thought. I thought it's so unfair that she's got to go through this. And part of me was thinking, if blokes had to do this, what the women had to go through, just absolutely astonishing, really. I remember just laying on my bed in my flat, and looking at the ceiling and just going, I've got a baby.
Yeah.
I've got a baby. And it was a moment that I'll never forget. I'll never forget that moment in that room, lying on that bed with my pie and mash T-shirt on and being a dad, actually being a dad. And she's like my daughter's 11 this year. And she is really, we're very, very close. She was a complete daddy's girl. And Audrey was born 2 years later and a completely different birth, much quicker, and a really so chubby baby. And it was, again, it was beautiful as well. It was absolutely beautiful experience, one that I'm so glad I was there for.
As an older man, I'm able to tell you well, warn you, there will be a day where both your daughters will tell you they hate you.
Oh, I've already had that.
All right.
I've already had that. I mean, it's yeah, I had that a couple of times with Arabella, and it's just starting to dawn on me now that I've got a wife and two daughters. And when we were buying our dog, the girl said, "There's a female available. They've got a girl one." And I said, "No, absolutely not. There needs to be some testosterone. I need someone, just someone." And I got my way, and I got Bud, my dog. But I'm completely outnumbered here, you know. And so yeah, there's the bants, as we call it, has already started because my kids really, really take the piss out of me. Like, I had long hair recently, a couple of days ago, and I read my youngest a story, and she looked at me and she said, "What's going on with your hair? You look like a crap beetle." I was like,
"That's a brilliant description."
What? Oh, I was just absolutely devastated. And that's basically what they do, you know, and it's going to get worse. And they're only 10 and 8. So I always think about, like, people say, "Oh, I'll tell you what, someone gets my daughters, I'll say, 'You look after my daughter, mate. You ever mess my daughter about?'" I'll be, honestly, good luck to whoever gets these ones, because they are going to give them a run for their money. You know, they're terrifying.
Brilliant. Well, I think any father, that moment of realising, yes, I'm a parent.
Mm.
I am a father.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary moment, isn't it?
I mean, I always... You forget how hard it is, don't you? But, like, those early stages, I think between the ages of, like, you know, newborn and four, you are really in the eye of the storm, aren't you? And we had our kids quite close together, and I remember when we had the first baby, and we were thinking, we're really good at this. This is it. We got this. This is easy. Should we another one? We're made for this.
Yeah.
Second one came along, and it was just, like... We didn't know whether we were coming or going. I mean, it was utter carnage. I mean, my wife handled it amazingly, but it was just, yeah. And we were very lucky because a lot of my work was abroad in the States. And when the babies are little like that, you can take them anywhere. But I always worry now. I think, God, if I got that job now, what would I do? It would be a nightmare.
Yes, it becomes impossible, doesn't it?
It does, because they get their own life. And their own friends, and they don't want to go to Los Angeles, or they don't want to go to live in bloody, you know, wherever for a few months. And
give
I
up their job
that.
And go live in Barcelona.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're not going to do that. But it's just talking to you now, I suddenly realise, you know, how far away those moments are, and actually they don't feel that far away, but they are. They're a long time ago.
Yeah,
and it is like, you know, Barcelona and things like that. I mean, it's, oh my God, like, I'm 40 this year. And so it's, I was halfway through my life. You know, it's just mad to think of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It flies by.
Well, there's also that thing of knowing when, you know, what do you make the choices are. I mean, I think when you do have a family, you know, you make massive sacrifices as an actor because your objectives completely change. And, you know, I remember being a young actor and I remember thinking the jobs I wanted to do were not about finance almost. They were more about me just being front and centre and being the star of this. You know, that was what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a serious actor and go off and do this thing. But I wanted this family. And then when you have a family, you realise actually you can't devote the time to being that person that other people have done. But also you think, I want to do that job because I really want to get that play swing for the kids.
Yeah.
And they'll love that. You know, you don't care anymore about the things you used to care about, you know. And I remember, like, every job that I choose to do now, it becomes about, oh, that would be good if I do that job because that would be great for us to go there and do that. And the kids need that.
Yes.
And the wife needs that. And they'll love that. If I get that, they'll love that. And that's just, you know, that's like anyone. That's anyone doing any job. Everybody does their job because they want to provide for their family, you know.
Yes.
My wife's very supportive of actually in what I do. I turn a lot of stuff down. And I'm sure when the chips are down, she probably sits there thinking, what a selfish bastard he was to turn that down. But she never tells me that. She never makes me feel like that.
That's nice.
And that is nice because I do think the partners really suffer. I think they really suffer. We suffer, and it is an insane business to do, keep the momentum going and whatever, and it's inconsistent. And we suffer through that, but that was our choice. But I think the partners, I don't think they never signed up for what they end up with, you know. And what people see is this kind of gregarious, outgoing character on stage and in the dressing rooms and in the green rooms and whatever, but they don't see this person walking around the house for 3 months thinking their career's over.
Why didn't I get that part?
Yeah, yeah. And watching television going, I can't believe they went for him. I can't believe it. What a boring choice. What a boring choice. You know, right the way through the whole film.
Yeah. The only time my wife really has ever told me off about it was that I went to Australia for 4 months when our baby was 3 months old and we just moved to a new house. And every night I would phone her up and just say, oh, I'm having such a miserable time. I really miss you. Really miss you. I want to see you and the baby. Why can't you come? And eventually she said, don't ring me again. Unless you're going to ring me and tell me something cheerful. She says, because it's hard enough, me being here with a baby. You're in Australia having a whale of a time. And all you do is moan about it.
Yeah. Well, see, my wife is the opposite. My wife wants to know that I'm having a terrible time. That's what she wants me to tell her. So I'm very careful about the information that I impart because I'm always having a wonderful time wherever I am. So I have to say, it's fucking miserable here.
Very boring.
I miss you, darling. It's not to say, oh, everyone's awful. They're awful. No, there's nobody here under the age of 30. And then, no, everybody's hideously ugly. And the food is rotten here. Because I've actually left my wife when I went off to do... I made 2 films in Australia. And the first one was in Sydney. The second one was in Perth. Both times, I had the most incredible experience. I loved Australia.
Mm.
I think it's brilliant. And I wish that we left all the convicts here and taken everybody over there and we'd all just gone to Australia. It was brilliant. It's a fantastic place. But
what is the title of that incredibly funny film about the wedding?
A Few Best Men.
A Few Best Men. If people have not seen A Few Best Men, they must watch it because your best man's speech when you're coked up is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a film.
It was one of those really lovely sort of gifts that you get every now and again. They don't come around very often. Stephen Elliott directed it. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, he directed. And Stephen was like this really, really brash Australian. He just like, wanted to fucking, just fucking say it. Just fucking do it. Fucking whatever. You know, like he wanted it to be ruder, more bored. I mean, he's brilliant fun, Stephen. I mean, really, really good fun. I mean, and Olivia Newton-John. So Olivia Newton-John, there's a scene where we're taking cocaine before the wedding speech. And she says, and she goes, do you know how I do this, Kev? And I said, what, cocaine? She said, yeah, I mean, how do you do it? And I said, come on. You know. You must have seen it in a film or something. She went, of course I've seen it in movies, but I don't know how you do it. How do you do it? How do you smell cocaine? And then Chris Marshall and I were not looking at each other thinking, who's going to demonstrate how this works? And she was just brilliant fun. And I remember she's got a lovely sense of humour, Olivia, a really lovely sense of humour. And we were in this place called the Lindenfels in the Blue Mountains. And I remember just playing tennis with her at sunset for just 2 hours, just playing tennis with Olivia Newton-John. She's an amazing tennis player. And we had the best laugh on that job. We had just had the best time. Myself, Chris Marshall and Xavier Samuels and a lad called Tim Drexel. It was brilliant. The whole thing was great fun. But that's you reminded me when you said about Australia. As I remember my wife was heavily pregnant. She was 7 months pregnant when I left and I got back and she was ready to drop.
Wow.
And I remember the whole time, the whole last month I was out there in Australia thinking, if I get that call, I'm 24 hours away.
I've got to go.
Yeah, yeah. I've got to go right now.
But luckily, you had over 40 hours.
Yeah. Right? Well, I would have done the first one. Yeah.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
Lucky.
We're going to absolutely put your daughter's birth into the time capsule.
It's yeah.
A beautiful thing. But I'm going to ask you now to put something in that you haven't enjoyed.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll put something in there because I never talk about this, but it's something that as I've gotten older, you reflect on your life and we think we're indestructible, don't we, when we're kids, and when we're young in general. And I think that lots of stuff happens to us when we're young that we would process completely differently as adults, and we just seem to put them into the back, and we've got that exuberance that just says, we'll get through this. No, I'm not going to get. I'm not going to let that define me. I'm going to let's move on. And really, they do. I think they come. They get you in the end. You know, yeah. They eventually come. And when I was 12 years old, I went to a school called Ravenswood School for Boys in Bromley, same school David Bowie went to. Mm. And it was last. Classes of the day, and we'd come into the classroom, and the headmaster at the time was Mr. Hassel, and he walked into the classroom, he stood up, and I thought, well, that's weird, he's come into the form class to talk to us. And then he said, I've got some very, very sad news for you. Stephen Granger lost his life last night. And Stephen Granger was my best friend.
Oh my word.
And he hadn't been at school that day, but I hadn't really questioned it. And he was on. He'd been on crutches because he had a Sever's disease in his feet, which meant it was like a growing thing. And he was on crutches. And what happened was he'd lost his life. He'd accidentally asphyxiated himself whilst doing his homework. He had a dog, and he would hook this dog lead onto things. And anyway. He had hung himself accidentally. And it was so traumatic, like I really, really just had the horrors at a really young age. I mean, I wasn't even 13. Yeah. And it was the first time in my life that I was aware of my mortality and that we could die, you know? And I think younger than people should know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
It was, yeah.
To become all that aware of, and so childhood innocence is a real sort of thing for me. I was like, you know, that it can be just. I remember it was snatched away that day completely, and the world was never quite the same again. You know, at that point, my best mate. And what was really horrible was we used to have these books called a contact book, and in the contact book, you could collect merits. There would be awarded merits from the teachers, and. Merits were hard to get, you know. They weren't. You didn't get them easily. And some kids, some of the SWATs had loads of merits, you know, the teachers' pets and whatever. But that merits came particularly difficult for me because I was, you know, so naughty. And the teacher had said to me a week before, Kevin, will you look after Stephen? He's on crutches. I went, of course he's my best mate. I'll look after him. That's fine. And one lunchtime. I love playing football, and my job was to take Stephen around on his crutches and help him get from A to B, and I just forgot and played mm-hmm. football, and I played football for lunch, and the teacher, I walked back after lunch sweating, I'd been playing football in all lunchtime, and the teacher saw me in the corridor, she marched up to me, Mrs. Hughes, and she said, give me your contact book. And I gave her the contact book, she opened it out into the merit that she'd awarded me, and she scrubbed it out in red pen. And then gave it back to me. And when Stephen died a week later, I had that contact book for the rest of the year. And every time I opened the contact book, which was every day, every lesson, every day, I saw the scrub. And it really, it's funny, isn't it? You put these things to the back of your mind. But just recently, I was thinking, God, that was really hard. And my mum used to sort of take me to the family. They were Italian. And they would wear black all the time. And then they would wear veils. The women would wear veils where they were in mourning.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was just really... I just remember it just being a really, really incredibly depressing year. Like, the whole time was just really awful. And I think I had a breakdown. I think I'd actually had a breakdown at that young age. I really think I did, because I'd hear like noises in my, like I'd hear screaming in the middle of a classroom. And I didn't realise at the time, but
no,
I just got through it. But I look back now, people said to me, oh, that's a breakdown. That's what happens when you have a breakdown.
Well, I think people underestimate how much children are affected by these sort of things. Mm. They feel that actually, but they don't really understand. It's not like being an adult where you understand the full consequences of things. But children also are fantastically good at just getting on with it.
Yeah. But there's also, if you talk to a lot of people that work in comedy, there's always some kind of, I always find something there. And it's a coping mechanism, comedy. I think it's a skill that we develop that to cope with, for in my case, I developed comedy to cope with sincerity. You know, I struggle with it. So when I'm the worst person to tell that your cat's died, because I will make a joke out of it, or I feel like I have to. So obviously, if someone comes up and says, "Oh, my mum's died," I'll sit there and I'll give them a cuddle and I'll be, you know, it's a somber moment. But there's something about sincerity with me that I'm very, very awkward around it. So I think that's where that skill, I was bullied as a kid because I was on, well, I think it was because I was on television, but also I was small and stuff. So I've learned very quickly that comedy got me out of trouble, and not just any kind of comedy, a charm comedy. Mm-hmm. So mine is always about trying to charm someone. My old thing always been, if you doing comedy and that person is annoyed, you've lost. It isn't working. You know, so if someone's in the seat, or whatever occasion, and they're in the chair, they should be laughing as well. If they're not, then it isn't comedy, it's bullying.
Right.
Or it isn't working. Yeah. It isn't serving its purpose as a comedic moment. So I always find that the comedy that I really like, the comedy I like to watch, is daft and inclusive, as opposed to, you know, spiteful or that kind of public execution. I've never really liked those. And I find the kind of, you know, when someone does something wrong on Twitter or in social media or something and people sort of hunt them down, I always find myself sort of feeling for the person, no matter what they've done.
Trying to defend them.
Yeah, trying to defend them, because I always find that it's like, I just never enjoyed that spectacle.
No.
You know? Never enjoyed that spectacle. I always feel like, you know, it's like watching an outnumbered fight, you know? It's not fair.
No.
Absolutely, 100% comedy is, to this day, and always has been, my way of bursting either tension in a room. You know, I will always say the most inappropriate thing, but it's needed, it's necessary at that moment. I always feel like, when you say something really inappropriate, it's really funny, and the stakes are so high that everyone laughs, because it's comic relief. It's exactly what it is. It's like, thank God someone said something. Well, all the funny people are thinking that.
Yeah.
You know, thank God someone said something funny at that moment, because it's unbearable. Well, obviously, if people watch a bad drama, they just look at each other and they go, oh, shit, and that's the end of it. You know, or if they go to see a bad play or whatever, I didn't enjoy that. If you go see a bad comedy, people are so offended.
Yes.
That you dared to try and make them laugh and it didn't work. How dare you waste my life trying to make me laugh? And I always find it hilarious, because I just think it's such a thankless task when it goes wrong. They can't just accept it. My problem with like doing comedy in the UK is there just doesn't seem to be the support for it. You know, you've got to be a comic here in the UK, you really got to nail it. You got to get it right, or they'll pull you to pieces. I think comedy means so much to us. It's very precious to us as a nation. I remember when I was in France working with. I've done a lot of work with the French over the years. I've got sort of a parallel film career. With European cinema that no one even knows about here, thank God. And and these the French, when I'm with them, they're laughing at me and giving you, he's really, you are so funny, and the things that you say. But you can see they're almost thinking, Why is he making us laugh?
Yeah.
Why is he trying to make us laugh?
Why is he bothering?
Yeah, why is he bothering? Like, they don't have a... It's that kind of thing, like, they expect the women to be quite sort of demure, and so Castor and I, we always, whenever we go, my wife's a good laugh, and she's a good storyteller, and she's a hoot. And I remember my friend is an actor, he said to me, Kevin, why are you and your wife, you are so close, you are really close in your life and much in love. What is the secret with that? Why do you love her so much? I went, well, she just really makes me laugh. He went, But that's not sexy, no?
Really?
Yeah. He couldn't understand that. Oh, I like having a laugh with her, you know? We kill time by, mucking around and...
Having funny faces.
Yeah, yeah, tuneful farts. That's how we laugh. As a nation, we're very protective about comedy, and we're very proud of our comedy heritage, and when it doesn't work, woe betide you for getting it wrong, you know?
Well, you don't very often, that's what I'll say to you. So congratulations.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, it's been lovely to talk to you. We're going to take that little book with that horrible red cross in it.
Yeah, I know.
We're going to lock it away. That's gone.
Yes, it's gone. Yeah.
Don't worry about it again.
Yeah, I won't. It's good. This has been quite cathartic. Well, do I have to pay you? You've got to invoice me for this.
Yeah, the invoice is on the way. Don't worry.
Yes, yeah, I really enjoyed it, Mike.
Great.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Kevin Bishop. You can subscribe to this podcast wherever you usually get your podcasts, or in fact, where you're listening to this episode now. Or you can try Acast, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. And if you've got a few minutes, you could rate us and leave a review. Be sure to spell check it. You'd be amazed how many people misspell simple words like amazing or brilliant or even astounding. Somebody even got the word great wrong the other day. They spelled it S-H-I-T. Yeah, honestly. Oh, that's homeschooling for you. Anyway, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. Just search My Time Capsule. You can't miss us. This podcast was produced by John Fenton Stevens, and the music is by Pass the Peas Music. It was a cast-off production. I hope you can join us again soon. No, really. I mean, honestly, it would be totally shit. Great. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.